We're in Luke 5 today, and we just said yesterday that Jesus' signs were not arbitrary magic tricks to prove his divinity. But Morgan, I have to be honest, if I were Peter with the tough financial conditions in the first century, I think I might be looking at this like a magic trick. Pretty excited to catch all these fish. How is this not just an arbitrary magic trick? Why is Peter falling down at Jesus' feet and telling him to leave him alone? What's going on here?
Well, I think Peter is having the proper response to any miracle because he's seeing the reality behind the miracle. So often we can get caught up in the blessings and see them as the main event, but miracles were always supposed to mean something and point to something beyond. For example, I think Peter is having the same reaction that we see Isaiah having in Isaiah chapter 6. He is seeing the Lord God himself. And Isaiah has the same response. He falls down and says, "I am a sinful man." And sinful men are judged and put to death when they get near God. So it makes perfect sense for Peter to understand, hey, if this is God, I need to get out of here.
Right, but he's not judged, right?
No, that's not what happens at all. Instead, we have Jesus commissioning Peter and the others who are with him to go out and be fishers of men. Bring even more people close to Jesus, just like Isaiah was commissioned to do. So instead of a vengeful and punishing God, Jesus is showing himself as someone who wants to bring people close, not push them away or smite them.
I think this is a kind of theme that we see in Luke 5 and maybe even throughout Luke as well. Like, God is not this vindictive God like I so often tend to imagine him as, but like Jesus is different, right?
Yeah, exactly. You look at the following miracles. We start off with the leper. And notice what the leper asks Jesus. He says, he doesn't say, "If you can heal me." He says, "If you will, if you want to, you can heal me."
Right.
Now, there were a number of things that would have made this leper think that Jesus doesn't want to heal him. You know, in the Old Testament system, there were a lot of things that created a literal distance between man and God. It's called being unclean. If you touched a dead body, if you found mold in your house or were menstruating, all of those would have had you thrown out of the temple complex, but only temporarily. Leprosy, though, it was permanent. It's a skin disease, can't be healed, and so they were viewed by the people of Israel as especially cursed by God. Now, being a leper is not explicitly sinful, obviously, but it's closely connected in the Jewish eyes. We have a few examples like Miriam or Gehazi, and both of them sinned and as punishment were made into lepers.
So this guy, he's full of leprosy, right? And doesn't that mean, according to the law of Moses, okay, you're going to have to go around, ratty clothes, unkempt hair, proclaim,
yep,
I'm unclean.
Yep.
And so like basically, wait, why doesn't Jesus then stay away from him, right? Isn't he breaking the law here?
Yeah, you can imagine that most people want to stay away from a guy like this, but Jesus, he's willing to reach out and to touch him. And that is an act that should have made Jesus unclean, but instead makes the leprous man clean and able to draw near to God.
So good. So through Peter, this sinful man, and the leper, Jesus is showing us that he wants to clean the unclean and come near to them. It doesn't seem from the rest of chapter 5 that that's the way the Pharisees saw things.
No, not at all. The Pharisees were very confident of who was in God's fellowship and who was out. For example, if you're not a Jew, out. You don't hold to the Pharisaical traditions, out. You're a sinner, you're a leper, out, out. And that's what Luke, I think, is really telling us through the story of the paralytic, that we can't be like the Pharisees forcing people out when Jesus wants to bring them in. You look at the paralyzed man, and this is someone who literally can't get to Jesus, A, because he's paralyzed, and B, you have the crowd preventing him from getting to Jesus. Now, look at verse 17, and Scott, who are the people that the crowd is made out of?
Yeah, these are the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. They've come from all over Galilee, Judea, and Jerusalem.
Yeah, and here they are literally keeping a man outside of the house and away from communion with Jesus.
Wow.
And so it reflects an attitude. We like that God wants to forgive me. That's what the Pharisees wanted. But I'm not so sure if he wants to heal that guy. In fact, I'm not even sure if God can. And this is what the Pharisees are thinking as they see Jesus interact with the paralytic. This is blasphemy. Who can forgive sins but God alone? I wonder if maybe even behind that question is the thought, would God have forgiven this man? But Jesus shows his purpose of drawing people in and near to him by forgiving this man and then telling him, get up and walk. You're not stuck where you are anymore. You can get up and follow me.
That's so good. I mean, Jesus, by the way, for the first time here, he uses that phrase, son of man. That's from Daniel chapter 7. This is the human mm-hmm. from heaven who's going to be given all authority. And here he's just said, no, this man's forgiven. So if I'm jiving with Jesus right and accepting this sign, I'm saying, who am I to question Jesus when he forgives somebody that I wouldn't?
Yeah. So we need to have the faith of the paralyzed man and his friends. If you look at Luke chapter 4, verse 20, Jesus is astounded by all of their faith, not just the one. So we should have faith that God can and will heal people who are classically on the outside. We need to make sure that there's no obstacle of doubt when we bring a sinner near to Jesus.
So speaking of sinners, what's so bad about hanging out with tax collectors?
So yeah, here's Jesus right after the paralyzed man, and he's having dinner with tax collectors. And people are upset because the tax collectors are collecting taxes for Rome. These are the hostile oppressors of Israel. To put it in a modern kind of image, imagine if America had lost World War II. And now, Scott, your neighbor has volunteered to collect taxes for the Nazi regime that's now ruling over us. And he's getting pretty rich off of it, too. How friendly are you with him?
I don't like that.
No, not at all. Because we're seeing him, he's part of the problem. We're trying to, if we're good patriotic Americans, we want the Nazi regime to end. And he is making them richer because of it. And so we should remember that these are the people that Jesus spent most of his time with. Not the super religious Pharisees or the people who claim to be righteous. He's out there finding the sick, the sinner. He's helping them get on their feet and follow after him. That's what he did with Peter. And Peter is then told to go out and find other sick sinners to help. That's what we need to be doing as well.
Yeah, so I'm struggling in my heart as I listen to this with this tension. I feel like then when I'm with my church family that maybe I'm not supposed to be right there. Maybe I need to leave them behind. Go focus on all these sinners out there. Help me get with this tension, get this tension right.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just Jesus dining with the tax collectors and sinners. If you look at verse 30, the Pharisees are grumbling at his disciples. And the question is not why do you, Jesus, but why do y'all, Jesus and disciples, eat with tax collectors and sinners? So Jesus does tell us to go out into the world, but not to leave our Christian fellowship behind. Rather, we go out in order to bring people into our communities. So all of that in Luke chapter 5, I think is a very just beautiful picture of a God reaching out to the lost in mercy. And then, Scott, in verse 33, all of a sudden we have this question of fasting, we have wineskins, we have garments and patches. What's going on at the end of Luke chapter 5?
Yeah, so the problem here is not only are Jesus and his disciples near everyone that they're not supposed to be near, the problem is they're eating. In fact, this is a theme throughout Luke. Luke talks about Jesus at meals at least on eight different occasions. And so many are convinced that Jesus is, well, just a drunkard and a glutton because, well, that's just not what the Pharisees did. They weren't eating like this.
So did the Pharisees just have a problem with eating in general, or what's their hang up?
Well, their thing was, their tradition was, they would fast twice a week on Mondays and Thursdays. And that seems really weird to us. I know we look at the Pharisees and we just think that they're crazy, but fasting, that was a godly thing in general if done right. And fasting basically, to use the language of Scott McKnight, is body talk. In the West, we tend to think of ourselves as just spirits, brains on a stick, but that's not the way God made us. We are body and spirit all woven into one. And fasting, there's There's a lot of good ways that it can be used, but primarily, if I were just to boil it down simply, I'd say it's a way that we help our entire self, body, and soul depend on God, especially in the light of difficult circumstances.
So the disposition of fasting is basically we're just putting our whole selves in this space where I know or feel that something isn't right, so I'm just going to put everything aside, even breakfast, in an effort to draw near to God. Is that right?
Exactly. I think it's so tough for us because when we go through difficult times, our like tradition is binge on ice cream and Netflix. Like, this is exactly what the doctor ordered. But I think we all recognize that at best, this is really only leading us to avoid our problems. And actually, maybe even at worst, it's leading us to a false comfort that's just not going to last. But fasting says, no, I'm not avoiding this problem. So that means if sin's been uncovered in my life or maybe in our community, fasting says, no, like I'm not just going to say sorry and then go eat a ribeye and chow down on some chocolate cake and ice cream with some hot fudge on top. No, like it's time to get in sync with God. Maybe you're about to start work on a difficult task or begin a new stage in life. Fasting combined with prayer, it makes us feel how weak and powerless we actually truly are to control the outcome of that project or that task or that new stage. It actually can teach us, if we do it right, to rely on God and call out to Him with more faith than we would have with prayer alone.
So all this fasting is prompted by the idea that something is wrong. Now, the Pharisees are fasting. What are they looking at? What are they feeling is wrong with the world right now?
Probably a lot of reasons, but really the main thing is, I mean, you go back to Anna. Why was she fasting? Why was she never leaving the temple? It's because God, the bridegroom of Israel, was not there. He was not present with His people. Malachi and Zechariah, through them, God urged the people, return to me and I'll return to you. So they're trying to return to God. They're trying to, the Pharisees, if we cast them in the best light possible, which I recognize we shouldn't always cast them in the best light possible. And Jesus said they had false motives. But if we are casting them in the best light possible, then we could say that they're interceding for Israel and pleading with God, come back, please.
Well, but God is back now. I mean, we got Jesus. He says, I'm the bridegroom that you've been waiting for so long.
Right. And that's exactly the tension point of this passage. Jesus is making that point. He doesn't just say, hey, like, you don't fast when you're at a wedding. I want you to notice specifically how he says, can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? He's hinting that he's the bridegroom. Fasting is a great practice if you do it for the right reasons at the right time. But if you continue to fast right now, you're rejecting Jesus as the bridegroom. You're rejecting Jesus as the God of Israel. And that's really what Jesus is urging in these parables throughout the rest of the chapter. He's urging for them to make a change in their old practice to match this new reality. They've been begging for God to come back. They've been fasting for that. And what he's trying to hold up the sign to say is, he's back. Change your practice. Get in line with this. You can't just slap a new patch on an old garment, right? It doesn't work. You can't take this new situation and the old situation and mix them together. You can't put new wine in old wineskins. The old garment can't handle, the old practice can't handle the new situation. The old wineskins can't handle the new wines. They'll tear, they'll burst. And in fact, Jesus explicitly says that the new and the old, they're not going to match. In the same way, our traditions, rituals, habits, practices, whatever we want to call them, they could be good things, but they need to make sense. And fasting in this moment does not make sense at all. The old tradition's good, but not when the bridegroom comes with the new wine of God's kingdom.
Yeah, and the sad thing is it seems that, according to verse 39, they should want the new wine, but they're just happy with the old. Like, Jesus, no, we don't want you to fix the problems. We don't want to draw near to God, especially when He looks like you.
Right. They're happy with the old. They're not willing to accept Jesus as the God of Israel. And I think that reminds us that traditions can be a good thing. I mean, Jesus had his traditions. His custom was to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath. The law said nothing about that, but that was a good tradition. But the danger for any of us is that we can fall in love with our particular tradition, however we do things, our practice, our habits. We can fall in love with that tradition more than the God that the tradition is supposed to be honoring and pointing towards. And I think that's really a good reminder and even a warning for us today when we think about this passage and what it says about fasting. Jesus says that when the bridegroom is taken from them, then they'll fast in those days. And I dare say that we're in the days when the bridegroom has been taken from us. It's so easy in the West to always fast when there's always more than enough. I think if we listen to the words of Jesus, we could say he expected his followers would set the fork down, push the plate away, and maybe spend more time than some of us do with empty stomachs on our knees, begging for him to return.